19. Scarathon. Labor Day marked the unofficial kickoff for the campaign sprint to the November midterm elections. The Democrats were trying to reclaim majorities in the House and perhaps even the Senate. Trump was not on the ballot, but the elections were a referendum on his presidency. For Trump, the very survival of his presidency was at stake. He and his advisors feared that if Democrats seized control of the House, they could bring impeachment charges against the president. The night of September 6th, Trump took the stage at the Metropark Arena in Billings, Montana, which was home to a marquee Senate race, and declared, "There is no place like a Trump rally." Trump defended himself against all these losers that say horrible things, including against those questioning his mental fitness. "I stand up here giving speeches for an hour and a half, many times without notes, and they say he's lost it. And yet we have 25,000 people showing up to speeches," the president said. He then extolled his political conquests. "I beat 17 great Republicans. I beat the Bush dynasty. I beat crooked Hillary." And lamented that media commentators still ask, "Is he competent?" Then Trump told his cheering supporters the real reason the Democrats had to be thwarted in November. "They like to use the impeach word, impeach Trump. But I say, how do you impeach somebody that's doing a great job, that hasn't done anything wrong? Our economy is good. How do you do it? How do you do it? How do you do it?" By the time he finished speaking, the president had made 38 false statements, according to the Washington Post's fact checker. Throughout the fall campaign season, Trump spoke regularly by phone, sometimes twice a day, with a handful of Republican loyalists in Congress, including Mark Meadows, the North Carolina representative who led the Freedom Caucus. Among all the Republicans in Washington, Meadows was one of those whose advice the president truly valued and sought out most consistently. Meadows provided Trump with regular updates on the so-called investigation of the investigators, the Republican quest to find wrongdoing in the FBI's handling of its initial investigation, Crossfire Hurricane. Trump's displeasure with Jeff Sessions had simmered for more than a year now. In his fall conversations with Meadows, Trump periodically expressed interest in firing the attorney general. Meadows urged patience, as did other voices in Trump's ear. "You can fire Sessions," he told the president, "but just wait until after the midterms, when Trump would have the backing he needed from most, if not all, congressional Republicans." Meadows and his colleagues on Capitol Hill agreed that the president had every right to have an attorney general he trusted, but firing Sessions before the election risked sparking a political backlash that could hurt the GOP's prospects. If Trump acted like an authoritarian, there was a danger that voters might take it out on Republican candidates, Meadows warned. Trump complained about feeling boxed in, but he agreed to give Meadows his word. On September 21st, Sessions was in his home state of Alabama, touring Auburn University to spotlight scientific research to combat the opioid epidemic. As Auburn's president, Stephen Leith, showed him around campus, Sarah Isker Flores's phone was melting down. The Justice Department communications chief was trying furiously to stop the New York Times reporters Adam Goldman and Michael Schmidt from publishing what seemed like an explosive scoop. Rod Rosenstein, in his first disorienting weeks as deputy attorney general and in the immediate aftermath of James Comey's firing, had suggested to other Justice Department and FBI officials that he secretly record Trump, and had discussed recruiting cabinet members to remove him from office for being unfit by invoking the 25th Amendment. If true, It would have been a huge departure from any normal investigative protocol. The supervisor of a high-profile investigation, especially a special counsel probe, would not normally jump into the investigative work or assume a secret undercover role. The Times reporters were confident in their reporting. Iskar Flores argued it was preposterous and also feared the report would unfairly spur Trump to fire Rosenstein. "You're going to cause a constitutional crisis," Iskar Flores yelled into the phone at one of the Times reporters. "Go fuck yourself!" Sessions and Leith were listening to Iskar Flores's end of the conversation. "She's spirited," Sessions told Leith in his thick drawl. Later that day, a Friday, the Times published the story. It landed like a bomb. Rosenstein disputed the account, calling it inaccurate and factually incorrect. He added, "Based on my personal dealings with the president, there is no basis to invoke the 25th Amendment." But the damage was done. Rosenstein assumed he would be fired. A scramble was underway to protect the Russia investigation and ensure stability at the Justice Department. Those practice drills Sessions, Rosenstein, and their deputies had gone over so many times in their heads were suddenly real. Sessions continued his trip in Alabama, but Iskar Flores rushed to catch a commercial flight back to Washington to help Rosenstein navigate the storm. Ed O'Callaghan, who had been traveling overseas, cut his vacation short and returned home right away. On Saturday, the president called Kelly with instructions: fire Rosenstein this weekend. Kelly argued against basing a decision on a New York Times article alone. The chief of staff had doubts about this story and at least wanted to hear from Rosenstein. "We gotta let him come in and talk to him," Kelly told the president. Trump, Kelly, Rosenstein, and Don McGahn traded calls over the weekend. The president vented his anger. McGahn mostly focused on how this could interfere with the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Rosenstein was trying to convince Kelly he should keep his job. Kelly had found himself in this difficult place more than once with a high-level government appointee. As the president would fume and rail about an appointee and threaten at varying decibels that he was going to give him or her the boot, Kelly would see the writing on the wall and try to ease the public servant out gently. "Go," Kelly would tell someone who had gotten on Trump's bad side. "It's not going to get any better." Kelly tried this with Rosenstein, but the deputy attorney general didn't want to leave and argued over the weekend that the Times reporting was misleading and, in his estimation, bore the fingerprints of former deputy FBI director Andrew McCabe. Aides at the Justice Department and at the White House nevertheless prepared for the deputy attorney general's ouster. Matthew Whitaker, Sessions's chief of staff, who was close to the White House and had been an outspoken critic of the Russia investigation before joining the administration, told Iskar Flores, "Rod will be gone. I'll be DAG. The president told me this." When Rosenstein caught wind of the Whitaker plan, he worried it might appear to outsiders like an effort by the president to interfere with the Mueller probe. On Monday morning, September 24th, Rosenstein showed up at his Justice Department office, knowing it might be his last day there. Iskar Flores popped into Noel Francisco's office and said, "Today might be the day. Hope you're ready to go." Francisco, the Solicitor General, was slated to take over control of the Mueller investigation should Rosenstein exit. Rosenstein was still upset about the Times story and angry about the rumors that he was being pushed out immediately and replaced by Whitaker. But he also had a strange calm after the harried weekend. He now assumed he'd lose his job and was solely focused on making sure he had a dignified exit. He didn't want to be tweet-shamed out of his office. Rosenstein had adopted a gallows humor over the months of attacks from Trump's GOP allies, who often predicted his demise and were proven wrong. In Rosenstein's tight circle, there was a running joke in the office about his nine lives. Die another day. Isger Flores got inquiries from reporters that morning about Rosenstein's resignation. She assumed the tips were coming from the White House, and she took the queries as a sign that Rosenstein's hours were numbered. Then Axios reported that Rosenstein had verbally resigned to Kelly. Isger Flores tracked down Rosenstein, who was in his office taking goodbye photos with his staff. "Sir, we're out of time," she told him. "Wait, let's take a picture first," Rosenstein told his trusted spokeswoman. "Sir, I need to talk to you immediately," Isger Flores said. "It's happening." Rosenstein then went to the White House in late morning, where he expected to be fired. Isger Flores put the finishing touches on a Justice Department statement announcing Rosenstein's departure, Whitaker's appointment as Deputy Attorney General, and Francisco's role overseeing the Mueller investigation. Inside the West Wing, Rosenstein met with Kelly and made clear he was no longer resisting. He said he would resign. He just didn't want an ignominious, abrupt ending. "If you want me to resign, I'll be happy to talk to the president, and we can negotiate a reasonable amount of time," Rosenstein said. "I don't intend to resign immediately." Kelly didn't demand anything, but listened instead. Rosenstein then went to meet with McGahn, who was about to head over to the Hill for the Kavanaugh hearings. In the early afternoon, just after Rosenstein left a National Security Council meeting, he talked by phone with Trump, who was in New York for the annual United Nations General Assembly. The call was cordial, even friendly, with Rosenstein saying that the Times story was wrong. "I don't want to fire you," Trump told Rosenstein. "Where did you get that idea?" Trump suggested Rosenstein visit him later that week at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. "I don't think that's a good idea," he told the president. "I'll talk to you when you come back to town." They decided to meet that Thursday. Despite the pleasantries of the call, Rosenstein still thought, "I'll be fired soon, just not today." Rosenstein became the latest senior government official left hanging in one of Trump's parlor games. "I think it pleases him to sort of paw at a wounded mouse in front of him because it asserts his sense of control and authority, and he enjoys that to no end," Trump's biographer Tim O'Brien told The Washington Post's Ashley Parker. Both behind the scenes and in public, some of Trump's most important advisors were telling him not to fire Rosenstein. The Friday night after the Times' Wire story broke, Sean Hannity said to his loyal viewers, including viewer number one, "I have a message for the president tonight. Under zero circumstances should the president fire anybody." Hannity, who spoke with Trump nearly every day, warned on air that the president's enemies were hoping and praying that Trump fired Rosenstein to lure him into a scandal. "The president needs to know it is all a setup," Hannity said. Some of Trump's attorneys were also throwing up cautions. Firing Rosenstein would only make it appear he was interfering with the probe once again. Before Trump's planned meeting with Rosenstein on Thursday, the threat of his ouster seemingly vanished, without so much as an acknowledgement from Trump that he had been demanding it. Trump and Rosenstein spoke several more times on the phone that week. They met in person the following week, aboard Air Force One on October 8th, for a day trip to Florida, and had a perfectly cordial conversation about a range of other topics. They were, in the acronym used by one Trump advisor who interacted with them on the flight, BFFs, best friends forever. In mid-September, Trump confronted a political crisis over Kavanaugh's embattled Supreme Court nomination. The hashtag MeToo reckoning had arrived at the doorstep of the White House. Christine Blasey Ford alleged, first in a private letter to Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then in an on-the-record interview published September 16th in the Washington Post, that Kavanaugh had sexually assaulted her in 1982, when the two of them had been high school students in suburban Maryland. Ford told the Post reporter Emma Brown that Kavanaugh corralled her into a bedroom during a house party, pinned her to a bed, groped her, pressed his body against hers, and, when she tried to scream, put his hand over her mouth to silence her. Kavanaugh denied the allegation. Ford was not the only woman to accuse Kavanaugh of assault, but she was the most prominent and most credible. Hers was a horrifying and serious allegation against a sitting federal judge, former senior official in the George W. Bush White House, and darling of the conservative establishment. Kavanaugh was under consideration to succeed retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy, a longtime swing vote on the bench, and his confirmation would push the High Court center of gravity to the right. Politically, the Kavanaugh crisis was a grave threat to Republicans on the ballot in November. Polling showed Trump and his party already underwater with women voters. The gender gap was growing wider during Trump's presidency. The percentage of women who said they leaned toward the Republican Party was 32% in September, down from 35% in 2016, according to Washington Post ABC News polling. But Trump had long been blind to the political liability of gender issues. Trump's instinct throughout was to defend his Supreme Court pick and muscle Kavanaugh's nomination through the Senate. He calculated that the mere act of fighting to protect a conservative jurist would endear him to his political base and galvanize conservatives in the midterm elections, especially evangelicals. For Trump, however, the Kavanaugh allegations were not just about politics. They were personal. The president himself had been accused of sexual assault by more than a dozen women and infamously bragged on tape of grabbing women by the genitals. The president was hypersensitive to the modern reality that a powerful man's career could be ruined by a single accusation, as had occurred to a litany of business and media figures, some of whom were Trump's friends or acquaintances. On September 26th, Trump inserted himself into the anguished national debate over Kavanaugh allegations and sexual assault more broadly by calling the hashtag MeToo movement very dangerous. In a defiant and freewheeling news conference on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, Trump revealed his myopic obsession with his own jeopardy. Asked whether the allegations brought against himself influenced his thinking about Kavanaugh's accusers, the president replied, "Absolutely. I've had a lot of false charges made against me, really false charges," Trump said. "I know friends that have had false charges. People want fame. They want money. They want whatever. So when I see it, I view it differently than somebody sitting home watching television where they say, 'Oh, Judge Kavanaugh, this or that.' It's happened to me many times." The next day, Ford and Kavanaugh both appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee for one of the most extraordinary days of public testimony in modern political history. The day unfolded like a play in two acts. First, Ford declared herself 100% certain that Kavanaugh was the prep school boy who assaulted her. She was credible. Kavanaugh was in trouble. Trump, watching her on television on the flight home from New York, thought Ford came across as Mother Teresa reborn. He was worried. Then, shortly after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Kavanaugh appeared. He practically shouted his opening statement denying Ford's allegations. His face was red with righteous indignation. He decried a calculated and orchestrated political hit. He was positively Trumpian, a performance artist spinning his own reality in direct contradiction to Ford's testimony. And Trump was riveted. He loved it. "This is why I nominated him," the president crowed privately. On October 2nd, with senators preparing to vote on Kavanaugh's nomination, Trump took matters into his own hands. At a rally that Tuesday evening in South Haven, Mississippi, he delivered a 36-second, off-script, ruthless jeremiad ripping into Ford's credibility with the pacing and delivery of a stand-up comedian. From the presidential lectern, Trump reenacted Ford's Senate hearing and mocked her memory lapses. "How did you get home? I don't remember. How did you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs? Downstairs? Where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember." Trump's advisors had implored him not to attack Ford, but he did it anyway, relying on his primal instincts for political combat. The Mississippi crowd of thousands was in stitches, hooting and hollering at the president's impersonation of an alleged sexual assault victim. Predictably, Democrats reacted with horror, as did some Republicans at first. But as Trump's mockery of Ford was replayed many times on television, the national discussion shifted to include doubts about the truthfulness of Ford's allegations. It became a familiar he-said-she-said debate. The president had also helped turbocharge momentum among conservative activists and made Republican senators more emboldened to muscle his nomination through. By week's end, on October 6th, the Senate voted to confirm Kavanaugh 50-48. His swearing-in 2 days later was a crowning achievement for Trump's presidency. Kavanaugh's ascension to the Supreme Court also was McGahn's swan song. The White House counsel had prioritized judicial appointments during the first 2 years of the administration, installing 2 conservatives to the high court and scores more to federal district and circuit courts. This left an enduring legacy. As soon as the Kavanaugh fight was over, McGahn was set to depart the administration, and not entirely on his own terms. Since late 2017, his relationship with Trump had been strained, but in the late summer and the fall of 2018, it deteriorated to the point where the two were barely on speaking terms. On August 18th, The New York Times reported that McGahn had sat for 30 hours of interviews with the special counsel team and that his testimony was central to Mueller's understanding of how Trump acted in key moments under review for obstruction of justice. This was a flashpoint. The Times story did not mention that several other White House advisors also had spent lengthy periods as Mueller witnesses, including Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon. It should not have been news to the president that so many of his aides had been interviewed by the special counsel. But in Trump's mind, it was evidence of McGahn's disloyalty. On August 29th, Trump decided to take a public stand and tweeted that McGahn would be leaving his position once Kavanaugh was confirmed. The tweet was preemptive. If McGahn wanted to reconsider his tentative plan to depart, he couldn't do it now. This was Trump's way of saying he was the one who decided which staff left and when. The president telegraphed to everyone that he was the boss. McGahn's final day was October 17th. Trump picked as his replacement Pat Cipollone, a well-respected commercial litigator and a conservative Trump fan. Since early summer, Cipollone had been informally advising Trump and his outside legal team about the Mueller probe. He also had a close working relationship with Emmett Flood, and Jared Kushner and Ivanka supported his hiring. In the weeks before the November 6th midterm elections, Trump barnstormed the nation, singularly focused on illegal immigration. He fixated on a slow-moving migrant caravan consisting mostly of families fleeing violence, traveling on foot from Central America, through Mexico, and toward the United States to seek asylum. Trump warned voters that the caravans were in fact a dangerous invasion of migrants, threatening the safety and prosperity of U.S. citizens. Privately, Trump demanded that his aides take tough action at the border to demonstrate strength. No one came under more pressure from the unrelenting president than Kirstjen Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security and a close ally of John Kelly's. Trump's relationship with Nielsen had been tempestuous from the start, as he made her a battering ram for illegal immigration. He routinely complained to other advisors that Nielsen was not doing enough to secure the border. Her defenders said she was doing all she could within the confines of the law. In some instances, the volatile president was verbally and emotionally abusive toward Nielsen. "Kirstjen, you're just not tough enough," Trump would tell her. Trump complained that Nielsen did not look the part of Homeland Security Secretary. He made fun of her stature and believed that at about 5'4", she was not physically intimidating. "She's so short," Trump would tell others about Nielsen. She and Kelly would try to make light of it. Kelly would rib her and say, "But you've got those little fists of fury." A number of federal agencies bore responsibility for managing the influx of migrants. The Justice Department housed asylum judges and administered the legal process. The State Department negotiated with Latin American countries and issued visas. The Department of Health and Human Services oversaw the care of migrant children. The Army Corps of Engineers managed construction of the border wall. But in Trump's mind, everything related to immigration and the border fell under the Department of Homeland Security, and he held Nielsen accountable for it all. At a cabinet meeting on May 9, 2018, Trump had berated Nielsen in front of roughly 24 administration colleagues over the rising number of illegal border crossings. In an explosive, extended tirade, a red-faced Trump excoriated Nielsen for not bringing him enough solutions. Then Trump instructed Nielsen to shut down the southern border. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, whose relationship with the president was the most strained of all the cabinet members, seized an opportunity to get on the boss's good side for once. Seated across the table from the president, Sessions interjected, "I just think we're not being tough enough. I think we need to shut down the border." Trump concurred and, turning to Nielsen at the far end of the table, asked, "Why haven't you shut down the border?" It was more of an admonition than a question. Nielsen knew this would be illegal, not to mention economically disastrous, because it could choke off trade routes. "I'm not sure what we are saying here," Nielsen said. "As the Attorney General knows, people have a legal right to cross the border and try to claim asylum. That's just the law." Trump looked back at Sessions. "No," Sessions said. "We should just shut the border down." Trump then lit into Nielsen. Why couldn't she use the power of her department to keep immigrants from flooding into the United States? What was so hard about this? Trump was so worked up that some attendees thought he looked manic. Kelly silently shook his head at Nielsen, to signal her to stop engaging with the president. Kushner made eye contact with Nielsen and moved his finger across his neck to signal to her to cut it off. It was clear to others in the meeting that Nielsen hadn't properly read the room or the president. By the time Trump eventually tired of yelling at Nielsen, nobody had stuck up for her, not even Kelly. He had decided that speaking up would only further provoke the president. After the cabinet meeting had concluded, Mick Mulvaney, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, said to Trump, "You know, the attorney general was wrong about the law. The attorney general is saying this, but that is not the case." But it was too little, too late. Trump's abuse continued episodically through the summer and fall. He harassed Nielsen with angry phone calls, waking her as early as 5 o'clock in the morning and routinely calling her at 6:30 or 7 a.m. as she was heading to work. He also pestered her late at night. Once, after the president had heard a rumor from a Republican lawmaker that a mid-level Homeland Security official had been disloyal to the president during a classified briefing, Trump became obsessed with getting the man fired. He had called Nielsen late at night, demanding she remove the official from his job. "That doesn't sound like something he would do, but I'll look into it, sir," she had told him. He had called Nielsen back early the next morning. "Is it done?" the president had asked. Nielsen explained that she couldn't check as her employees had been asleep overnight. Trump regularly called Nielsen after watching Lou Dobbs' nightly show on Fox Business. Dobbs delivered regular diatribes about illegal immigration, proposing unrealistic solutions and castigating Nielsen as a squish. To Trump, the Dobbs monologues were gospel and created in the White House a near-daily drumbeat. The president would routinely call Nielsen to say a version of, "Did you see Lou Dobbs? You're totally fucking embarrassing me. This is my issue." One of his go-to complaints was, "They're killing me," a reference to Fox coverage of immigration policy. "You've got to fix it," he would demand of Nielsen. Sometimes Trump would refer to one of Dobbs's proposals and say, "Kirsten, just do it. Just do it." "But we can't do it," Nielsen would explain, usually because whatever Dobbs had uttered on TV was against the law. Other times, when Trump would call Nielsen and demand she execute one of Dobbs's ideas, she would interrupt the president's yelling to inform him, "Sir, we're already doing that. I briefed you on that the other day." Nielsen recognized the power Dobbs had over Trump and saw that his commentary was infecting her relationship with the president. The White House communications shop had tried to book Nielsen on Dobbs's show, but he had declined, saying, "Nielsen wasn't my cup of tea." As the volume of border crossings spiked, Dobbs had a show focusing on the administration's failure to enact 3 ideas to secure the border. Nielsen shook her head as she watched. One proposal was legally shaky. The second had already been discarded by the administration because it was impossible to implement. And the third was something the administration was already doing. Nielsen called Dobbs from her car to correct him. Her aides listened fearfully, sure she would start yelling at the TV host, but she was gracious. "Lou, we'd be happy to help you with your reporting," Nielsen said. "If you ever need any facts or statistics or one of our experts, we'd really be glad to provide it." She then went over why the 3 ideas he had outlined on air were not workable. Within hours, Trump called Nielsen. He was excited. "Did you call Lou Dobbs?" he asked. She said she had. "That's great," Trump told her. "Lou says you're very smart." One of Nielsen's tactics for when Trump asked her to do something illegal or something that violated a regulation or a treaty was to ask him, "Okay, sir, What are you trying to accomplish here? She would then try to figure out a legally permissible way to achieve the same result, and often arranged briefings to try to inform the president what he could and could not do. Let me bring people in, Nielsen would tell Trump. You don't have to trust me. But the briefings rarely made an impression on Trump. Just when Nielsen thought an illegal or unfeasible idea had been put to bed, the president would awaken it. Trump did not see the law as an impediment, a mindset forged as a real estate developer. A developer could always just sue, battle it out in court, and negotiate some middle ground. Look, we'll get sued and then we'll work it out, Trump told Nielsen during one such discussion. Just block people from coming in. Stopping people from seeking asylum was a favorite solution of the president's. But he had many ideas, and they would sometimes feel like a sandblast of suggestions, any one of them violating the International Conventions on Torture, or U.S. rules requiring the study of environmental harm, or regulations governing competitive contracts. Lawyers from the Department of Homeland Security and the White House rarely pointed this out to Trump. Nobody wanted to get him even angrier. Just as he used to recoil from McGahn's repeatedly telling him he couldn't do some of the things he wanted to do, Trump got frustrated with Nielsen. Federal law enforcement doesn't work like that, Nielsen told Trump in one such meeting. People could get in trouble. These people have taken an oath to uphold the law. Do you really want to tell them to do the opposite? Then we'll pardon them, Trump said. Nielsen knew that every time she asked her agency heads within the Department of Homeland Security to fully secure the porous U.S.-Mexico border, they would complain that the only solution was for Congress to close legal loopholes. A migrant seeking asylum had to meet a fairly low bar to gain entry, stating that he or she had a credible fear of retribution or harm back home. The overwhelming majority would later be denied asylum based on their circumstances, but by the time of their hearing, they had often already disappeared into the country. On immigration policy, there were many critics and no sponsors. Many offices had to review policy and legislative changes. The National Security Council, the Domestic Policy Council, the White House Counsel's Office, the Chief of Staff's Office, and the policy coordinators, as well as Kushner and Stephen Miller. It was rare for an idea to survive that gauntlet, and a near miracle for anyone to actually champion it and do the work required to implement it. Kelly sometimes tried to protect Nielsen's turf, once telling Kushner, "You should stay out of it," because Nielsen was in charge of immigration policy. The White House was so broken, one administration official later remarked, looking back on this tense period on immigration policy. There was no process. Ideas would come to the president in a no-process method. Half-baked ideas come into him. God knows how. It was totally disorganized. To this day, no one is in charge at the White House. No one. In late October, with the caravan on the move, Trump badgered Nielsen almost endlessly. He suggested lining up border agents and other officers to form a sort of human wall along the portion of the southern border that lacked fencing, roughly 1,200 miles of the 1,933-mile border. A statistician at Homeland Security figured out it would take hundreds of thousands of people standing arm to arm to create a line that long. The number, a conservative estimate, was immediately discarded because it was so staggering. We were like, this is absurd, one aide remembered. Nielsen and her team, including the leaders of Customs and Border Protection and U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, met for a brainstorming session in downtown Washington's Ronald Reagan Building. Sitting around a conference room, they discussed how to satisfy Trump's increasingly difficult demands to deny entry to illegal immigrants. The officials felt as if they had already scraped the bottom of the barrel for new options. They contemplated a number of ideas, including sending U.S. Marshals to the border, borrowing personnel from another department, or creating a volunteer army. They figured they had to throw some bodies at it, if only to sate Trump. National Guard units had deployed 2,100 troops to the border since the spring, and some Homeland Security officials suggested ramping up the presence dramatically to create, as one aide put it, a huge show of force. At this moment, the border situation was relatively calm. There was no crush of migrants, the caravan was still a few weeks away from reaching the border, and the humanitarian crisis in overcrowded border stations would not unfold until several months later. One senior agency official interjected to point out that additional personnel at the border was not necessary, at least not yet. "This is ridiculous," the official said. It was not, however, ridiculous to Trump. He was adamant about sending troops to the border, telling aides that the military had tens of thousands of men and women in uniform, and he should be able to use them as commander-in-chief to protect the sovereignty of the United States. Advisors explained to Trump that if he sent troops to the border, they would not be allowed to function as if they were law enforcement officers. They could erect temporary fencing, or fix vehicles, or conduct surveillance, advisors said, but they could not use deadly force. Firing a single shot into Mexico would be considered an act of war. In late October, Trump decided to use his authority as commander-in-chief to deploy military troops to the border to guard against migrants. On October 29th, the Pentagon announced that it was sending 5,200 troops, as well as Black Hawk helicopters and giant spools of razor wire. This was the largest mobilization of active-duty troops along the U.S.-Mexico border in decades. The next day, Trump floated the idea of sending 15,000 troops to the border, an extraordinarily large number that was roughly the size of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. The move immediately inspired howls that Trump was playing politics, militarizing the border to scare voters and turn out his base in the midterm elections, which were now just a week away. But Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis vouched for the mission and said the military was providing practical support to Homeland Security operations. "We don't do stunts in this department," he said. Nevertheless, Trump made clear that his rush to put troops at the border was about taking strong action to galvanize his supporters to vote Republican in the elections. "If you don't want America to be overrun by masses of illegal aliens and giant caravans, you better vote Republican," Trump said on November 1st at a rally in Columbia, Missouri. For Trump, deploying the troops wasn't enough. He wanted images, propaganda, distributed through the media showing the military presence. Trump sent word to the Pentagon that he wanted pictures of troops at the border. The presidential demand landed on the desk of Dana White, Mattis's press secretary. Kevin Sweeney, a retired Navy Rear Admiral who was serving as Mattis's chief of staff, told White that the White House needed to see pictures of troops, and fast. White tried to explain this would be unrealistic. This was the Department of Defense, not Coca-Cola. Troops would not be moving to the border instantaneously, even after they received orders. "I can't give people pictures of something that's not happening," White told Sweeney. "That's your problem, Dana," Sweeney said. "Just get the damn pictures." The pressure wasn't coming from Sweeney, of course. It was coming from the top. Trump had pushed the entire military apparatus to help him illustrate the show of might that he had ordered up, which could convince voters that he was protecting the nation from the dangerous invasion of migrants that was getting closer each day to a showdown at the border. Sweeney and every senior agency official knew the fastest way to please the president was to get the message on the station he and his fans power watched. "Get something on Fox immediately," Sweeney told White. Trump just didn't understand that U.S. armed forces don't simply hop on a C-17 one night and start patrolling the banks of the Rio Grande the next afternoon. "No one would push you to show that except the one person who doesn't know," a Defense Department official said of the president. Mattis's aides agreed that to satisfy Trump's wishes, they would have to get pictures of National Guard troops and asked state National Guard officials who hadn't yet shipped out if they could snap photographs or shoot video of their reserve troops training at home. The first images they finally got, after more than 24 hours of hustling, were of the Texas National Guard, the first to have images of troops in drills. "People were more focused on the pictures rather than what we are allegedly doing," the Defense Department official said of the White House. "The urgency wasn't on the mission, it was on getting the pictures." Trump also wanted to see military generals being interviewed on television news, preferably at the border and in a commanding role. Word came down from the White House that images of National Guard officials were not good enough. By November 3rd, the first wave of military troops had arrived at the border, and photos emerged of uniformed service members installing razor wire fencing along the Texas side of the Rio Grande. Trump remarked at a campaign rally in Montana that evening, "We have our military on the border, and I noticed all that beautiful barbed wire going up today. Barbed wire, used properly, can be a beautiful sight." Trump sought to frighten voters in the final days of midterm campaigning by using the threat of an invasion of illegal immigrants to stoke fears of cop killers, or as Trump called asylum seekers, bad hombres. Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader poised to become Speaker, called Trump's fear-mongering a scare-a-thon. This period amplified Trump's ugliest characteristics as president. "He goes out and says crazy, horrible things, blows race whistles, and sits back and watches his topics of craziness dominate cable TV for the next 24 hours," said Mike Murphy, a Republican strategist. On Election Day, November 6th, Democrats seized control of the House and picked up several key governorships in the Midwest and even Kansas, propelled by a rejection of Trump's demagoguery in the nation's suburbs, especially among women voters. But Trump's demonization of immigrants helped Republicans expand their majority in the Senate, where the 2018 map had strongly favored Republicans with most of the competitive contests in such red states as Missouri and Texas. The Democratic triumph in the House was powered by a record number of women candidates. This would be the most racially and gender diverse freshman class of representatives in congressional history, and Pelosi was set to reclaim the Speaker's gavel she lost 8 years earlier. In her election night speech, Pelosi signaled that House Democrats would use their subpoena power to investigate Trump and hold his administration accountable, as Republicans had not. "Today is about more than Democrats and Republicans," she said. "It is about restoring the Constitution's checks and balances to the Trump administration." The next day, Trump predicted, presciently, it would turn out, a warlike posture should House Democrats use their new power to investigate him. "They can play that game, but we can play it better, because we have a thing called the United States Senate," Trump said at a news conference. I think I'm better at that game than they are, actually. Trump refused to show any contrition or take responsibility for his party's defeats. After the 2010 midterm elections, President Obama talked about his party's shellacking. And after the 2006 midterm elections, President Bush spoke of his party's thumping. But Trump didn't even acknowledge the loss. Rather, he claimed, very close to complete victory. Trump did achieve a victory of another sort that day. Finally, he got rid of Sessions. As election results were still being tallied the night of November 6th, Trump told advisors he was eager to axe the attorney general right away. The next day, Sessions was gone. Everything had seemed so normal the night before. Sessions, his wife Mary, Rosenstein, and aides Isgur Flores and Stephen Boyd were hanging out in Boyd's Justice Department office watching the election returns on Fox. Sessions knew he was not long for Trump world. Internalizing his own fragility, the attorney general had taken to quoting from Princess Bride to staffers as he left the office at night. Good night, Wesley. Good work. Sleep well. I'll most likely kill you in the morning. On November 7th, Kelly called Sessions. The president wanted him to resign. Sessions summoned his aides to his office. It's happening, the attorney general said. Come on up. It was surreal. Rosenstein counseled Sessions to try to leave on his own terms. Pick a date, Rosenstein said. Make it 2 weeks from now. We'll have a farewell party and an appropriate send-off. It's humiliating for you to just walk out. You've been advancing his agenda here. You've gotten a lot done. You have a lot to be proud of, and you shouldn't have to leave under these circumstances. It was Wednesday, and Sessions asked Kelly if he could have until Friday to resign, but Kelly wasn't the decider. He checked with the president and called right back. It has to happen today, Kelly informed Sessions. If it doesn't happen right now, there will be a tweet. Sessions stood behind his desk as he held up the phone, his suit jacket removed and wearing a white shirt, red tie, and glasses. He had long ago drafted a resignation letter, and Isgur Flores immediately started touching it up on her phone. The team debated what his first line should say, and Sessions decided to begin with, "At your request," making it clear he had not resigned voluntarily. In the letter, Sessions highlighted his work at the Justice Department to enforce immigration laws and prosecute gang violence. Notably, he called the rule of law, which Trump had so often tried to override or thwart, a glorious tradition that each of us has a responsibility to safeguard. An assistant printed a copy on Justice Department letterhead. Sessions signed the bottom, and Boyd and O'Callaghan volunteered to hand-deliver it to the White House. When they arrived in the West Wing, a young staffer asked to take it, but O'Callaghan wasn't about to hand the Attorney General's resignation letter to someone who looked as if he had just left college. He and Boyd asked to hand it directly to Kelly. When they came face-to-face with the Chief of Staff, the Justice Department officials thought he looked stressed and pained, visibly conflicted about what he had just ordered. They were surprised by how complimentary Kelly was of Sessions. He's done a great service to his country, he told O'Callaghan and Boyd. The instant O'Callaghan and Boyd handed Kelly the letter, Boyd texted Isgur Flores. Back at the Justice Department, she had already briefed a handful of beat reporters on Sessions' resignation and read them his letter under a strict embargo so they could prepare stories. With Boyd's signal, Isgur Flores lifted the embargo, and the journalists published their stories and pushed out news alerts. About 90 seconds later, Trump tweeted the news. The Sessions team had long prepared for this moment, and they were not about to let the president scoop them. Ordinarily, the Deputy Attorney General would have stepped into the void left by Sessions' sudden exit, but Trump bypassed Rosenstein. He named Whitaker acting Attorney General. A Trump loyalist, Whitaker had publicly criticized the Mueller investigation as a legal commentator before joining the Justice Department as Sessions' chief of staff. As chief, Whitaker had alienated Sessions' loyalists and quickly established himself as a palace fighter, firing some officials and attempting unsuccessfully to cast off others, including Isgur Flores, the attorney general's trusted confidant. Now Sessions' temporary successor, Whitaker seized control of the Russia probe. Finally, Trump felt he had his hands on the wheel. Later that afternoon, Sessions' staff filed into the attorney general's conference room, where Sessions gave an impromptu farewell speech. His celebratory walkout from the department aired on live television. Sessions didn't even have a chance to clean out his office. Papers were still stacked on his desk. Files were still open. His nameplate and family pictures were still displayed. The bag in which he carried classified materials was still sitting on a chair. But Sessions had gone home, relieved of duty. After nearly 2 years of cruel harassment from Trump, Sessions was loath to criticize the president, even in the confidence of friends. The president didn't even bother to call the attorney general to demand his resignation. He made Kelly do it. Yet Sessions still admired the man he met at that Senate hearing on the United Nations all those years before. Sessions was still in awe of the passions Trump stirred with his former constituents back home in Alabama. He saw in Trump so much fight, so much moxie. "You know, this guy just has that dragon energy," Sessions remarked to one of his political friends. "He can't be tamed."